episode 59, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Garland Garris, lead for quantum security and post-quantum cryptography at Accenture Federal Services. The team discuss timeline predictions to break RSA, methods of protecting current information in a post-quantum world, and the potential threats of Y2Q. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, how you doing, Cyprian?
Hey, Patrick. I'm doing well and looking forward for another great episode of Entangled Things.
That's excellent. This one is right up my alley, I think. We're joined by Garland. Garland, can you introduce yourself to our audience?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Patrick. So I'm Garland Garris. I work for Accenture Federal Services, and I'm the lead for quantum security and post-quantum cryptography. I've been with Accenture for about 2 years and recently left the Federal Bureau of Investigation, where I worked for 15 years, with my last assignment being senior leader responsible for enterprise cybersecurity throughout the agency.
So that's the tip of the spear. I mean, you've got a big job ahead, because quantum security is coming whether we like it or not. Do you have any opinions on how much time we have, or have we already run out of time?
Yeah, that's really the multi-billion dollar question, right, with, you know, funding pouring in as it is. And it's really difficult to say. I think that a lot of the assertions or predictions that have come out in recent years, you can see they just leap to the left and, you know, in fits and starts. And go ahead, sir.
No, I was just going to point out, you may have seen these and I've brought them up before. The thing that really struck me is back in 2015, there was a study that said that Shor's algorithm could be used to break RSA 2048 with a billion qubits, which was so many, it might have been, you know, a zillion. And then a short 4 years later in 2019, another study came out that said they could do it in 20 million. And so that number is shrinking very fast. The number of bits that are being put onto these boards is increasing fast. And so it's really, we're looking for that crossover. And I don't think anybody can predict it. But I think as you seem to have indicated, I think everyone's being wishful about predicting it later than it might actually happen.
Sure. And there's been advances in so many complementary areas that have really moved these to the left. So if you go back to RSA years ago, RSA conference in the 90s before Dr. Peter Shor's algorithm, then there was this great graphic, which I use in my briefings to customers, where it shows if you could somehow take every computer on the planet, put them to common purpose, then it would still take 14 billion years to crack one asymmetric key. So this is in the 90s. And then, of course, Dr. Peter Shor came out with his algorithm, and you went from 20 or 14 billion years to 20 years or 10 years or however long it takes to attack a specific key standard with a quantum computer of a specific size. So, you know, you think of that order of magnitude increase, and we've consistently seen the same. So we've gone from having 50 qubit computers to this year, I think IBM came out with a 433 qubit computer, and they're on track for 1,000 qubit computer. Not error corrected, of course, but, you know, still with the funding pouring in, advances are being made. And then to your point, as far as that paper goes in 2015, I read that one as well. And 2019, from 1 billion to 20 million qubits needed. And what we're seeing is there's advances in different types of quantum computers being made, but there's also advances being made in quantum error correction. I think we're pretty much right on the cusp there of that paying off. And until, you know, just a few years ago, that was largely theoretical. So there have been advances in so many different areas that are sort of converging. And I think the term Nevin's Law, you know, like Moore's Law, has come up, where advances are happening in fits and starts. And that was explained as being advances as an exponent of an exponent, instead of, you know, Moore's Law was just doubling capability every 2 years. So,
yeah, and there's a lot of room for disruption. Cyprian and I were talking about the DARPA relationship with Microsoft and others who they see as potential disruptors who could spring us forward if their big bets pay off, such as Majorana, fermion-based quantum computing, because if that comes about, it might not have the error problems that other formats have, and we could find ourselves suddenly confronted with a shorter timeline. So it's a multidimensional equation, which is always always bad for threats.
Yeah, the rub there with error correction, of course, is with traditional error correction that we have seen is that when you introduce error correction, you also add a level of complexity, and then you add additional noise. So you have to get to a point that the amount of errors or noise you're adding is less than the correction that you're achieving. And
there's a great analogy from storage in this, and actually, you know, Cyprian with the big data has probably seen some really big storage arrays. As you add drives to a redundant storage array, you actually increase the likelihood that one of the drives is going to fail because their mean time between failure starts to rise. So you might have, you know, 100,000 drives in a data center, and it's very unlikely any of them are going to fail, but one of them is going to fail every week because it's just the law of large numbers. So I think error correction, if you think about it that way, the more of that you do, the more susceptible you are, because now you're using more qubits that can have errors. We need more reliable qubits is really the path we need.
But it's even more than that, Patrick, because with the current known error correction algorithms in quantum, right, up until quite recently, they were doing significantly more harm than good. Essentially, adding error correction was essentially destabilizing those quantum systems to the point where error correction was not that it wasn't helping, it was actually
bringing a lot. It was bringing its own bag of errors with it.
We've just recently started to hear folks who are deep into error correction, right, saying, look, we are approaching like the tipping point where error correction is actually going to help. So in quantum, I believe that's a very kind of interesting, and it's significantly different from classical because the way those algorithms are designed.
Right. Well, as the Stoics and Marcus Aurelius would say, is we're kind of at the whims of that fortune. We should concentrate on what we can fix, not the thing that we can't control, which is when this arrives. So your job is probably very much encompassed by helping people understand what they need to do to be ready for this, as opposed to trying to predict when. How's that going?
It's going quite well, and it's really always an active conversation with customers. And the conversation varies depending on the customer. Some are starting from scratch, and of course, you know, quantum being pervasive throughout popular culture and seeing it everywhere, there's a lot of disillusions you have to deal with. Quantum computers being needed to address post-quantum cryptography. For example, one of the customers I briefed recently, I was describing some of the policy requirements and what they needed to do to inventory their crypto. And I got a one-line response that said, we don't have quantum computers, you know, which sort of missed the point a little bit.
Misses the point.
Right. But however, I've been surprised. Some of the customers that I've interfaced with, and especially if they're staffed by very academically minded individuals, then they don't only understand it; they're excited, and not just because you know they have to address the downside or the dark side of quantum computing, but they're excited for the upshot and you know all the possibilities that quantum computing brings. My oldest daughter's graduating with her bachelor's degree in chemistry this year, and she's starting her PhD. Facets wow. of that program use quantum computers to do molecular simulation, you know, for treatment of cancers yep. and other things. So I can get stuck on talking about all the wonder that we're going to see over the next two decades with quantum computers. And then I'll go to the dark side and helping agencies understand, well, this is actually what you're up against as far as is dealing with the threat that quantum computers bring.
I mean, your daughter's in just the right place. It's like being a computer science major in the late 70s that she doesn't know what she's in for because chemistry is going to be revolutionized by the quantum. But the NIST has come out with their finalists now. crystals, Gladys-based has come out as the pretty much the clear winner in NIST recommendations. Are you finding that you tell customers, hey, you got to deal with this? Are there enough vendors? Are enough tools? Or are there enough? Is there enough maturity now for them to actually do what they need to do, or do they look at you and say, well, okay, but there's nobody to help us do it?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge in talking with customers about these new algorithms is twofold. One is we've been using RSA and elliptic curve cryptography and, you know, our existing cryptography for 4 decades, and it's worked and mm-hmm. it's trusted, you know, it's everywhere. And talking about this, this threat, which seems distant, you know, it's basically closing that gap and then getting them to trust these algorithms. The way in which the competition occurred with NIST, I think, was done so in a very academic way. And there was a few algorithms thrown in there that needed additional research. And then, of course, when psych fell, that was not helpful mm-hmm. because it was...
Well, that was an implementation failure. It wasn't the fundamental failure discrediting of the algorithm, was it? That was just the implementation, but that doesn't help. I agree.
That's true. Well, I mean, it's based on a, and I'm talking beyond my knowledge level here, but basically Esogeny based cryptography, which hasn't been around nearly as long as lattice based cryptography. So, only about a decade, and a new attack was found on Psyche, which broke it on a laptop in less than a day, where the security parameters which were set up for Psyche were broken. So the perception of some in government and private sector is that, okay, well, that's sort of glummed in with the rest of these algorithms. Why should I trust these?
Right.
And one thing to dispel when talking with customers is that crystals specifically, it wasn't developed specifically for this competition. It'd been really the product of research for years. And NXT and IBM have been collaborating on development of these algorithms for a long time, long before the NIST competition began. And it was really built upon research from prior attempts where IBM and others basically said, well, let's take the best parts and put them together. And point being that it's something that has been incredibly tested by academia. And the biggest challenge with these lattice-based signatures is that they're significantly larger than what we're using now. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you're talking about two certificate authorities in chain for RSA 1024, you're talking 2.5 kilobytes. Whereas dilithium 4 is about 15 kilobytes. So that may not sound like much, but if you're looking at configurations with your network and you're trying to connect over secure shell, or you have TLS connections that are happening, you know, hundreds of times per minute, that increase in certificate size is incredibly significant. So there's going to be a burn-in period for these that is going to require a lot of effort.
What no one really realized is that we were just one exploit away from RSA coming crashing down. We just never found it. If suddenly someone found a vulnerability in RSA, and I'm not saying that there is one, but I'm not saying there isn't. All 0 days are there before we look for them. We just didn't know what they were. In 20, 30, 50, 100 years, we might find out that RSA had all sorts of vulnerabilities we just didn't find while it was active. And so we always have this leap of faith with encryption protocols that we're not going to find its Achilles heel. It's not going to develop a vulnerability while it's active.
Yeah,
so it's always leap of faith.
I think, Patrick, there is also the other very interesting aspect that we've encountered many, many times discussing, like getting ready for post-quantum, is capture now, deal with it later, mm-hmm. aka decrypt it later, right? And I would really like to hear your opinion, Garland, on, like, is there a sense of urgency? Do people understand that this is something that it's something of a of a real threat when you think of the context of future quantum computers that could be used to decrypt information that is collected today and might be still valuable for various reasons.
That's a great question.
Five years from now.
Yeah, I think that is well understood. I think it's better understood and appreciated by specific customers on the federal side. And there, I mean, in the intelligence community and law enforcement who actually deal with this on a regular basis, where you see data being captured from a specific victim, be it private sector or public sector, in encrypted form or otherwise. Of course, my data was stolen in the OMB hack. Hopefully it's encrypted somewhere. But that's a good example. There have been countless number of other intrusions which will not make the paper. And certainly in my time working for the government, I dealt with several of those. But the approach is pretty much standard for specific nation state actors. You know, we do see this from China. We see this from Russia. And it's every opportunity to get into a federal agency, steal data. We'll figure it out if it's valuable later, but we want to take it and then decrypt it when we can and just store it in bulk. That's definitely a continued approach.
Have there been any efforts to make petabytes of data available to them so that we can bankrupt them and drive consumption?
Oh, geez.
Maybe Encrypt Mary had a little lamb over and over again.
So the answer to that is yes, as far as erroneous information. Good. And then, not necessarily a honeypot, but if you can actually get them to put a large level of effort into trying to steal something that has no value, then if anything, mm-hmm. you can actually study their means and methods and tactics, and you can counter those to protect what actually is valuable. So
I love honeypots. That's one of my favorite concepts is make them waste their efforts on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that I also wanted to ask, maybe kind of switch gears a little bit, is we talk about a lot of quantum computing in terms of Shor and breaking RSA and things like that. I believe there is the other side of it in terms of quantum communications, which is also something that I believe will have a significant impact, especially in things like quantum key exchanges and things like that. So I'm curious, like, how much of that do you encounter in discussing with potential customers? Or, like, are people aware that there will be at some point a revolution in the communication space as well? And that might even occur earlier than the one in computing, if you ask me.
Yeah, so specific sectors are definitely focused on that. The national labs, for example, agencies that are based in satellite communications are incredibly interested there. And of course, the Chinese government itself has put a large investment in quantum key distribution through their SATCOM system. So it's something that's a topic of research and focus, but it is within those specific agencies that really are based on communications research right now, so not most federal agencies. And as far as the diaspora of vendors that are in the space, there's even fewer that are focused on that, in my experience, than in coming up with crypto agility platforms or a solution to help customers gradually migrate to these new algorithms from what they have. So it's something I'm incredibly interested in as well. And I have talked with a number of vendors who are working in the space and clients. But it's not something that is as focused on as PQC itself. And at this point, because of policy that's driving federal agencies' activities, right now it's about inventory greatly. So, federal civilian executive branch agencies, national security agencies, they have specific deadlines that they're focused on, just from a compliance perspective. And then also with the passage of the quantum computing Cybersecurity Preparedness Act, December 17th, that's another bar. So when OMB sets out memos and when the White House sends out NSMs, that's policy. And that's something that they have to try to comply with. But if you're a CISO, you can write to OMB or the national manager at the NSA and say, hey, this is an unfunded mandate. We're doing what we can. A legislative requirement that's law, that's different. So there's certainly a lot more focus now and agency spend that's going into this, which is good to see.
So you mentioned something very important, which is that inventory. You need to know where you're using encryption, and that quip from the uninformed manager of "I don't have a quantum computer" is illustrative. In the cybersecurity world, as I you likely know, and I'm sure many have heard, there's a movement afoot to get the Software Bill of Materials, or SBOM, to be a normal part of our day-to-day, because you can't fix a log4j problem if you don't know where you're using log4j, and a camera, a router, a switch, they all are opaque if you don't actually do the homework to figure out what software is on them, what components those software use. And I think this is part and parcel of the same problem we have with the encryption. If I'm using RSA, Elliptical, or Diffie-Hellman anywhere, I'm not really going to be able to go fix that unless I know in the inventory where it is. And so are there tools? Are you looking at the MITRE SBOM framework? Are there other tools that would help an organization identify where it's using encryption that could be vulnerable to a quantum computer? In other words, public-private key encryption for the most part. Are there tools out there that I'm missing? Because I'm only seeing those tools developed in the SBOM frameworks.
So there are a number of tools and solutions available that are offered by emerging companies that we partner with. And that discovery happens really on three levels. There's on the operating system and actually scanning. There's over the network as cryptography goes across the wire. And then, as you mentioned, there's the build process. So if you're including something like log4j or some embedded symmetric or asymmetric key that you use, let's take the government, for example, with GOTS, government-created software, then that has to be discovered really at build time. Because after you're dealing with a binary, you're not going to detect it. Perhaps you will over the wire. So there's three different really discovery areas. And there's a few companies that
are
emerging. There are a few companies that we are working with that provide solutions for that. And then, of course, our security teams are talented in iterating through it manually. So, and it depends on the agency. If you're looking or working with a large agency, let's take Department of Energy or Air Force, for example, they are huge. So even if you have a discovery capability, you have new systems coming online weekly, if not daily. So it has to be integrated with your authority to operate process, your information assurance process, so that you can stem the bleed, because you can detect what you have. And if you're inserting new symmetric and asymmetric algorithms on the fly with global organizations that are staffed by millions of people, then you have to really address that at the policy level. But there are solutions out there which can help companies and agencies do this discovery.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we're going to need is a vendor certification of some sort, similar to like the Energy Star that we had on refrigerators and ranges and things, so that I know when I'm buying something that it's not using any quantum vulnerable encryption. And I think we're still a good ways away from that, but that has to come from either government or industry has to launch something so that because otherwise it falls to the end user, and they as you say, they're buying things faster than they can probably vet them.
That is an excellent point, and I think that's perhaps a role that CISA can play in providing that validation, at least for federal agencies. And that is certainly a role that we play as I'm evaluating vendors to take to a customer. Accenture Labs will spend a lot of effort looking at a solution to see if it actually does add security or simply complexity. And we have seen that in some vendors where really you're still relying on the same key standard, still has the same vulnerabilities to quantum computers, but because you add in these other layers of really obfuscation, then the perception is it adds in security when in fact it does not. So that's part of our job is to, cut through that.
One of the big misconceptions I've seen is that you talk to a developer because Cyprian and I are both developers in our in my deep dark background and his daily day to day probably still. And so when you talk to a developer, they say, okay, well, what kind of encryption are you using? Oh, well, you know, we encrypt everything with symmetric keys. And then it's like, okay, well, how are the symmetric keys protected? And so they believe that their 99% of their encryption is symmetric, but the symmetric keys are protected by asymmetric, and that's what's vulnerable. And so they get this false sense, and it's similar to the, I don't have a quantum computer. They're just looking for an exit ramp as fast as possible. But so it only has to be one section of the code that's vulnerable, and then everything else is wide open. And so I think these are the types of lessons and perceptions that we all have to try to stamp out, you through your role and us through this podcast.
Absolutely. And, you know, messaging and getting customers and clients informed is part of it. For me, when, you know, and we talked about when this is a threat, I always make the assertion that it's now. And the reason is not necessarily because quantum computers can crack RSA or ECC now. It's because for large agencies, if you're Deutsche Bank or you're the Air Force, whatever, it's going to take a long time to migrate. You know, this is a generational change of technology, which we haven't seen in a very long time. So it's going to take
It's
planning. It's going to take investment. It's going to take time to iterate through. And the time to start on that's now. If we're pessimistic in our assumptions with when an adversary creates a capability to be able to crack cryptography, let's be pessimistic and say, well, that's me being pessimistic is saying 10 years because I don't, I really don't buy the 20 years it's going to take. But if it's 10, then it'll be a push for agencies to get done in time. Let's be even more pessimistic and say 20. When I worked for the government and for the FBI, it wasn't uncommon for me to classify data for 50 years. So depending on who you are and what you're protecting, it's already way past time to start working on this.
Yeah, missile silo secrets last for decades, not for just a few years.
Yeah, and it's collection capability as well.
Go ahead.
Sorry, it's collection capability, right. Really.
So something I brushed over as I was talking earlier, and I wanted to get your take on it, is I focus on Shor's algorithm a lot because I'm in security. Grover's algorithm is more Cyprian's jam because he's big in the data. Grover's is a threat to symmetric key encryption, but not nearly to the extent. It basically, if something takes 10,000 years with classical computers to break, it's 5,000 with a quantum computer of the similar capability. I don't really lump that in. I don't tell people they have to replace all their symmetric keys because I don't believe it's the same threat. Do you guys have that same stance that it's the asymmetric standards that need to be swapped out, not the symmetric?
That's right. We validate that customers are using AES 256. And if you're at that level, then I consider a customer safe from Grover's algorithm.
Okay.
You know, so
any rebuttal, Cyprian? You want to defend your guy?
No. I fully agree with a caveat, right? We're talking the current version of Grover. We don't know what we don't know, right? So we might see some new either variant or some completely new algorithm emerge that would change the game. But with what we know today, like I concur.
Yeah, and one of the parts of the conversation in education as well. It's like, well, why don't we just switch everything over to symmetric? And this is, you know, for folks who do not understand how PKI works and the fact that you have a tremendous key distribution problem then, you know, but
yeah. We'll just have everyone show up in the same place every Thursday. That's all. We'll exchange our keys.
Right. But
and get their keys, right?
That's right.
To Cyprian's point,
what could go wrong?
There's the way that advances are happening in quantum information science, it's not predictable. So we are one threshold discovery away from Grover's becoming a problem to AES 256. You know, no one could have predicted Dr. Peter Shor would have come up with his algorithm, which basically mitigated the whole strategy for, I'll just increase the key length and that makes it better. And of course, his algorithm is even more efficient the longer the key is, so that doesn't help.
Right.
So it's going to take one brilliant person to come up with a novel solution. And that's something that is somewhat unique to quantum computing, is that it's not just the hardware and it's not just error correction. It's, you know, people's ability to come up with novel, unique, brilliant solutions that work in this new area of quantum computing, which is just so different than what we're used to, that, you know, it's wide open.
We're very lucky Peter Shor came up with it when he did, because if he came up with it 2 years after we had computers powerful enough to actually break RSA 2048, the scramble would be murder instead of just
the other urgent. Thing that is happening also to the point that you made, Carl, is I think up until now the algorithm development part was mostly theoretical, and I believe we are at the point where we move into a whole new era of algorithm design in quantum, which will benefit from folks actually having computers and devices, albeit limited. I agree, right? But for me, if I'm thinking doing a parallel with classical computing, right, it's a whole different ball game of just thinking like with pen and paper about algorithms or with the mathematics in front of me, as opposed to having devices where I can test various things. So what I would expect is with this first rudimentary generation of quantum computers, right, and even more importantly, with the second generation of quantum computers that will be here probably in like a decade, I suspect we see more and more fuel into the algorithm space, because people will actually have devices to test their ideas on, to kind of see what works, see what doesn't, and so forth. So my take on it, and I would really like to hear your opinion as well, is that algorithm design and the, let's say, the way that the space of algorithms will evolve is ahead of a very steep curve in terms of acceleration.
Absolutely agree. And I think that's driven by this tremendous investment, you know, which as discoveries are made, and it acts like a catalyst for additional investment, which of course fuels additional research and competition between, you know, nation states. Also, 2019, when Google claimed quantum supremacy, it was what, 2 weeks later when China was able to do the same thing. What took Google minutes, they did it in seconds, using a completely different approach, using photonics and, you know, different algorithms. But this is all being driven by this flood of funding that's coming into the space, and also interest. And as I'm sure both of you guys know, when you first got introduced to quantum computing and quantum information science, you were curious. And then as you learned a little bit more, you got hooked. And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what happened to me. D-Wave created the first quantum computer only 13 years ago. And, you know, you look from that to where we are now. And I was lucky enough to be included in a D-Wave class when I started Accenture. And I expected to be fascinated, hear a great briefing. To my astonishment, I was programming a quantum computer in 1 hour. And then as I peeled the onion, I found out, okay, well, here are the subset of problems that you can tackle with a quantum computer. And Cyprian, to your point, people are discovering new problems that you can tackle with quantum computers all the time, and developing, you know, new algorithms to make existing problems more efficient. And, you know, it's just a green field for discovery. But this funding, again, you know, $2021, I think it was $24 billion. And, you know, $10 billion of that being China, only $1 billion of that being the U.S. So, you know, there's a tremendous race going on. And I like to make the analogy between Y2K. And I've got enough gray in my hair to where I actually was working as a programmer during Y2K. And in 1999, dollars, there was something like $600 billion that was pushed into this to solve this problem. And of course, the differences are Y2K wasn't malicious. It was because you had a mainframe and you wanted to use 2 bytes of memory where you should have used 4, because memory was at a premium. Y2Q is a term that's being used now, you know, trying to determine when that's going to happen is a little, it is, can't, could be malicious. You know, nation states are trying to get quantum advantage before their adversaries do. You know, but it's certainly greenfield. To Cyprian's comment, there's a lot of different novel approaches that are being discovered all the time. The funding is driving that discovery, and it's exciting at the same time terrifying when you see the advances that are happening and what that can mean to customers that don't have as much time as they think they have to actually counter the potential threat.
Yeah, it's kind of opaque. We have this big landscape of commercial development, which is clearly on the Western power side. The fact that D-Wave's a Canadian company, and IBM and Microsoft and, you know, Quantinuum and all these others, the West is just killing it on the commercial side. But we really don't know exactly where China stands. Authoritarian governments tend to toot their own horn more than democracies do. It's kind of interesting to see that the Russians, the Chinese were all about announcing their hypersonic missiles, and the US kind of acknowledged it because they had to, because of the others. And so we see this like, oh, hey, we did this development. And so I wonder whether China's threat in quantum, which is the one that I'm most concerned about, is a paper tiger similar to the Russian tank forces that evaporate in front of modern weapons. But we can't take that chance. We have to fund based on the potential risk. And I think the potential risk is quite high. They've made some assertions that are very dubious. They claimed that they could break RSA. And when it was picked apart, it was based on some real, you know, bad assumptions about how things would scale that they were doing. They weren't doing anything at scale. So I do question whether they're the superpower in quantum they want us to think they are. But again, I don't think we can afford to take that chance.
No, absolutely. And to that specific paper that you're referencing, which I think came out about 6 to 8 weeks ago, it was difficult to actually understand the assertions that they were making. And there was sort of a play on words. It was based on a professor over there named Shorer, not Shore, and an algorithm that he developed. But that was, the assertions were dispelled, and, you know, there was a little conjecture there that you would take the capabilities of quantum computers, combine it with a more traditional methodology, and then be able to crack RSA at a much shorter time. And it's feasible that there's going to be an approach like that, where you're combining two separate approaches, quantum and traditional, perhaps AI, machine learning, perhaps distributed quantum computing, you know, like I said, greenfield of the possible. And we don't know. But Patrick, to your point, the risk is just too high to wait, because this isn't something that you can be agile in responding to. It's going to take time. And for large agencies, they turn about like the Titanic, you know, small course corrections. It takes a while to move your resources so that you can deal with it. And what's at risk is, well, could back up and say, how pervasive is technology within our lives? And of course, it's everywhere, you know, from the iPhone in your pocket to the cameras on your house and, you know, whatever. I've got a Jeep Rubicon. It has 6 routers inside of it. You know, all that data is encrypted. The industrial control base, all the electricity that you and water that you receive, our financial systems, all of it reliant on cryptography. So the risk is huge, and you know, not a gamble that we can take. So thus the need to go through and determine what's the lift, what's the level of effort to actually adopt these new algorithms, dilithium and Kyber. When the standard comes out, I'm, for myself, when I'm talking to customers, I'm helping them do their inventory, helping them come up with a plan and a roadmap. And the NIST standard is supposed to be released next year, 2024. And I'm asking agencies, as far as adoption, you can test, you can do some experiment pilots, but you know, let's wait till that standard comes out before we go through an actual migration.
Yeah, but you need the planning can happen now. Sorry, Cyprian, go ahead.
The other thing that you brought up, I think, is very important. I just want to maybe point it out for our listeners, the hybrid thing, right? Like, even as we discussed about Shor's algorithm, right, it is the quintessence of a hybrid approach, because quantum does not solve the problem of factorization, right? Quantum is used to solve the problem of order finding, which is one small part of, well, small, not small, but one part of the whole thing, right? So you would typically have a classical computer working together with a quantum computer to solve the problem. And some of the things that we see with a lot of the platform companies that we talk with is significant effort is put into the hybridization, moving that kind of point of interaction between the quantum and the classical closer and closer to the quantum world, to the point where you would be able to execute classical code from within the quantum environment. So I think that's another like huge direction that we see, and it will have a significant impact on what I already kind of dare to call hybrid algorithms, yeah. Where the challenge is not only to find the genius quantum algorithm, but to find the genius combination between the classic and the quantum algorithm that would solve very, very complex problems in a very efficient way.
I think that's right. Yeah,
and I think that's how we see the evolution happening, is that, you know, right now it's sort of stovepipes. You have D-Wave with their Oceans API and IBM with Qiskit, and, you know, it's focused on their specific quantum computing implementations. I think that going from that, you're going to end up with another layer of obfuscation where you have this quantum computer coupled with other systems that you have an API that sort of traverses both and gives you another capability stack, where, Cyprian, to your point, you cut out the piece of the problem, like with Shor's, that quantum can solve, which, you know, whatever intractable NP-hard issue, that piece of it goes to the quantum computer. And then you've got another, you know, you're using this layer of obfuscation and high-level API that you put to a more classical computer, and you come up with a more seamless solution. And I think that's where we go within the next few years and decade. Now, this is all conjecture, according to Garland, but right. That's how I see it evolving.
I think it's a good scientific estimate there. So we're running out of time. Time flies when you're having fun. Is there anything else that you would like to bring up or highlight before we wrap it up? It's been a great discussion so far.
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys. It's been great, great conversation. As far as points I would leave folks with is that, you know, right now, understand where cryptography is. Most agencies don't. So if you're a company, you've got cryptography everywhere, and probably you think that your ITS or your information assurance program knows where all of your cryptography is, and that's usually not the case. I'd say it isn't the case 100% of the time. So you have to understand that now. Now's the time to do it before the standard comes out, and you're going to be well positioned to address this generational change of technology that's coming. But start there. It's not something you have to wait for.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like asking someone, where's all the nickel in your house? I don't know. There might be nickel-covered screws. There might be nickel-covered, you know, whatever. You need to do the inventory. You need to do the heavy lifting. And I like the way you're approaching it. So I think we're in good hands. So appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, sir. And again, appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thank you. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Bye, everybody.
All right, bye.
Bye.